much for inviting me to come be here and learn with you this morning. Our topic is going to be about siblings and the nature of the relationship of siblings. And if you look at the very first source on the sheet, it's not number one, it's a line above number one. There wasn't really a source for it. I pulled it off of Amazon. It was actually a plaque that you could buy and give to your sibling. And it says, "I smile because you are my brother. I laugh because there is nothing you can do about it." Right? And I think that really encapsulates the dynamic of the sibling relationship, that there's a lot of ambivalence and tension in the nature of the relationship. There's really two extremes when it comes to how we relate to our brothers and sisters. Yeah, I'm sorry. Getting used to this venue here. Okay. So on the one hand, let's take a look at source number one. I am not a psychologist. I don't pretend to be one. So these may not be the most accurate psychological sources that I pulled here, but I think that they will definitely give us a good insight into what I'm talking about, into the contradiction of the relationship of siblings. So source number one, it says, "From the time we're born, our brothers and sisters are our collaborators and co-conspirators, our role models and our cautionary tales. They are our scolds, protectors, goads, tormentors, playmates, counselors, sources of envy, objects of pride. They help us learn how to resolve conflicts and how not to, how to conduct friendships and when to walk away from them. Bigger sibs learn to nurture by mentoring little ones, and little sibs learn about wisdom by heeding older ones. Our spouses and children arrive comparatively late in our lives. Our parents leave us too early. Our brothers and sisters," says family sociologist Catherine Conger of the University of California, Davis, "are with us for the whole journey." Right? So on the one hand, this is the essence of the sibling relationship. They are the people in our lives who we really are the closest to. Genetically, we're the closest to them. We come from the same source and the same DNA. And in terms of our life experiences, they are with us for the entire journey, from the time we're born till the time our lives end, right? Our parents leave us early, our spouses come in late, but our siblings are with us for the entire journey of our life. We share experiences, we share history, we share family dynamic. We can sit and reminisce about stories. I'm just honored that my sister is here with me today, talking about siblings. She's here visiting from Israel, and the few days she's been here so far, we've been reminiscing about times when we grew up, and you know, there's nothing like that relationship. It's the closest of close. All right, so that's on the one hand. But then you have the other pole. You have the other side of the relationship. Take a look at source number two. "The term sibling rivalry was coined in 1930 and popularized by the child psychiatrist David Levy, who gave his patients celluloid dolls that represented their parents and younger siblings and asked them what they felt when they saw the baby brother or sister doll nursing at its mother's breast. There ensued scenes of sibling carnage to rival anything in the Old Testament. Among the responses recorded by Levy, dropping, shooting, throwing, slapping, hitting with stick, hammering, tearing apart, scattering parts, biting, crushing with fingers, crushing with feet, crushing with truck, and piercing with a screwdriver. Levy, who repeated his experiments among the Quechua Indians of Guatemala with similarly gruesome results, concluded that regardless of age, gender, birth order, or cultural background, sibling rivalry is a fact of family life." And then he concludes in this article that he wrote for the New York Times, "Show me a sibling who experiences no sibling rivalry, and I'll show you an only child." Right? No such thing. The nature of the relationship, putting aside the closeness and everything, the life experiences and DNA that's shared, the nature of the relationship is inherently competitive, right? Siblings are always competing for the love of the parents, and that translates itself into competition over everything and anything you could possibly imagine. Right, so in addition to my sister being here, my daughter is here too, who is one of seven siblings in my family, and I will not embarrass her by sharing too many personal stories, but we're all smiling when we read this. We all know it. What we see with our own children, remember growing up with our own siblings. And even in the most ideal of circumstances, where the parents are sensitive and really try their best to be equal to all of the children, it doesn't help, right? I know my kids always fought over who got to sit in the front seat. And my brother used to have in his house, when his children were little, a chart hanging over the sink of who got to wash first. Because that was World War III on Shabbos lunch. It wasn't like now where you've got three sinks in your kitchen and the washing station and the dining room. They had a more modest home. There was one place to wash, and they couldn't enjoy Shabbos lunch because the kids were all fighting over who got to wash first. Right? They find anything and everything. There was a story reportedly of JFK and his brother, Robert Kennedy, that they literally broke out into a fist fight over a piece of chocolate pie. Who got to have the piece of chocolate pie? And again, no such thing as siblings without rivalry, despite the popular book that is out there. So again, this is the psychological reality of the relationship. You have two extremes. On the one hand, they are the closest of allies, and on the other hand, they are the bitterest of rivals, right? How do we reconcile this, this polarity in the relationship? And the question that I want to explore with you today really is, how does Yahadut deal with sibling relationships, right? Given that this is the psychological reality, where is the Torah's view on all of this? How are siblings supposed to relate to each other? Do we have specific requirements and obligations and responsibilities to our siblings, reflecting this close nature, reflecting this shared DNA and common experiences and lifelong connection? Or is there an acknowledgement of the rivalry that's inherent in the relationship and not so much as expected of siblings towards one another? So, we'll take a look at the sources and we'll see where the Torah weighs in on this contradiction. One thing that we do see is that, the certain mitzvot require us to view our fellow Jews and fellow human beings as our siblings. Right? For example, v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. You're supposed to love your neighbor as you love yourself. It doesn't say specifically love your brother as you love yourself, but your reicha. We say, kol Yisrael areinim ze laze, right? We're all responsible for one another. It's not limited to members of our immediate blood-related family, but the extended kol Yisrael family, we do have an obligation to each other. But that doesn't exist specifically for siblings, right? When I started to research and see what halachos are there that are requirements for siblings, honestly, there really wasn't that much to find. So we'll look at them together and we'll see what the source of these are. Source number three, the Gemara in Masechet Ketubot, right? I think we're all familiar with the mitzvah, Kaved et Avicha v'et Imecha, right? We have to honor your mother and your father. So the Gemara comments there, Vav Yitera, the Kaved et Avicha v'et Imecha, the Vav in front of the et, that extra Vav, it says, L'rabot et Achicha Hagadol. Why is it there? To include in this mitzvah of honoring that you have to honor your older brother. And the Shulchan Aruch codifies this law. It says, Chayav Adam in source number four. The Chavod Achiv Hagadol, a person is obligated in honoring their older brother. Bein Shehu Achiv Me Aviv, Bein Shehu Achiv Me Emo. Right? Whether it's a paternal brother or a maternal brother, in either case, the obligation of honor is there. It's not the obligation of fearing, it's the obligation of honoring. So when you start to analyze this mitzvah and how far it stretches in terms of what is one obligated when it comes to honoring their older brother, there's a lot of debates in the different halachic opinions. One debate is, does it apply to older sisters as well? Right? If it was, I'm a little bit in trouble. She's older. So the answer is it's a debate. We do have a source that is held up as a proof that one is obligated to honor the older sister. Look at source number five. This is Ula, who was a Rav. Ki hava ate mi be Rav, when he would leave the synagogue, hava menashek lehu l'achateha abe yadehu, that he would kiss the hands of his older sisters. Right? As he would leave, as a sign of respect, as a sign of kavod, he would kiss his older sisters' hands. And Rashi says specifically, mishum kavod, that these sisters sort of raised him. I guess there was a great age difference, and they had a significant impact on his upbringing. And as a sign of kavod, as an obligation of kavod, he would kiss their hands. There are other opinions that say not. It was just because they raised him, not because they were the older sisters specifically. But Rabbi Abad Yosef comments that one should be strict on this, and it should be a function of honoring the older sibling, not just the brother, but the older brother or the older sister. Another debate, interesting, that comes up is, does this apply only when the parent is still alive? So one opinion says, yes, it's only if the parent is alive does the obligation exist to honor the older sibling. But once the parent is gone, then the obligation no longer exists. So what does that tell you about the nature of the obligation? That it really seems more like an extension of honoring the parent. Right? It's not really because there's some inherent closeness or bond or connection between the siblings, but it's really just an extension. The older sibling kind of takes the responsibilities off of the parent. I should say the parent gives a lot of their responsibilities to the older sibling in terms of child rearing. So as an extension of honoring the parent, certainly the parent would want to see the younger children respecting their older sibling because they give them that authority, and it won't work if the children don't buy into that authority. So it's, again, we see it's not necessarily a reflection of this closeness in the sibling relationship. It's more a function of the age and a function of honoring the parent and the parental responsibilities. Okay, so that's one halacha that we see with, in terms of sibling relationships. Source number six. A second halacha we see comes in terms of avelut, when it comes to mourning. The Rambam says, Elu she'adam chayav lehitabel aleihem din Torah. Right? The Torah obligates a person to mourn for these relatives, imova aviv, a mother and a father, beno ubito, a son and a daughter, achiv v'achoto me'aviv, and the paternal brother and sister, umidivrehem, and the rabbis added on the obligation, she'itabel ha'ish al ishto hanesua, that a man has to mourn for his wife, who he is still married to, v'chein ha'isha al bala, and a wife mourns for her husband, umidabel al achiv v'al achoto shehein me'imo, and on the maternal brother and sister as well. So there is an obligation to one's siblings, unfortunately, in a time of mourning and of avelut. But again, we see it's not just siblings that are singled out. It seems to be a function of family relationships, family dynamics, blood connection, or in the case of spouses, that commitment to each other. The halacha doesn't seem to point out specifically there's something unique about the sibling relationship that we create this obligation. It's really just a function of the family relationship in general. So siblings happen to be a part of that, but it's not reflecting any uniqueness to the relationship there. Okay, the third halacha that I found that deals with siblings' obligations to each other is the mitzvah of yibum. So here we see a little bit of what I'm trying to get at, a little bit of the connection between the siblings, right? What's the mitzvah of yibum? Look at source number 7. Ki yeshvu achim yachdav, right? When the two brothers live near each other, umeit achad mehen, uvein ein lo, and one dies without children. Lo tia eshet hamed hachutza li'ish zar, the widow should not marry some strange man from the outside. Ivama yavo aleha ulacha lo leisha v'yivma. Right? But instead, she should marry the surviving brother. He should be the one to marry the widow. Vayaha b'chor asher teled, and the child that those two will have together, yakum al shem achiv hamet v'lo yimachesh mo b'Yisrael. That child will then become, you know, kind of the continuity of the brother who passed away. He will be a living memorial for the brother who died prematurely, who died too soon. So the Sefer HaChinuch explains the nature of this obligation. Bear with me, it's a little bit long, but I think it's worth reading what he has to say. It says, Mishar Sheya Mitzvah, Lefi, word source number 8. Lefi Sha'isha Acher Sheni Sein La'ish. The root or the explanation of this mitzvah is that when a woman is wed to a man, Harehi ke'achad me'aveirav. She is like one of his limbs, right? The connection between a husband and wife is as if they are one body. She'keini chayiv hateva mipnei ma'aseh ha'av harishon. And this was put into human nature in the days of Adam Harishon, right? When God created the first man. She'lukha achad mitzalav, that he took one of his ribs, u'mimena banalo hakel isha. And from that, God created the woman, right? So bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, husband and wife are as if they are one body. But if a man dies with no children, and he's got no memorial, no one to fulfill him in this world, in the service of God. And there's no remnant of him in the physical world anymore. Zulati zota isha shehi etza me'atzvav uvasar mivsaro. Right? The only remnant he had was his wife, who was physically part of him, but certainly not DNA-wise. Hayam michaste hakel alav lahakim lo zera mimena al yedei achiv. So it is a chesed of God, right, that he created this mitzvah, that the brother should lahakim et lozera, that he should establish a seed from himself, shehu gam kein kachatzi b'saro, because he is also like his own flesh, right? Just like the wife is connected to the brother, so too the brother is connected to the brother. There's that closeness and that genetic relationship that it would be a way of continuing the legacy of the brother. So that he can have a child that will fill his place, and serve God under him, and give him a zechut in the spiritual world where the brother has now gone on to. Okay, so again, we say, we don't have to read the end, but we see from the Sefer Achinuch's description of this mitzvah that here there's a recognition of the closeness between siblings, right? One brother can physically replace the lost brother by getting married to the widow and creating a child, having the same DNA, having the same closeness, the same nature of the relationship, and this child can really be a continuity of the brother that passed away. The only thing about this mitzvah is that it's not obligatory. It's a choice. Right? It's a beautiful thing. It's a tremendous chesed for one brother to do for another. But it doesn't have to be. There's another option. What is option number two? Chalitza. Right? If for whatever reason, let's say the widow doesn't want to marry the brother-in-law, or the brother-in-law doesn't want to marry the widow, or in the most famous case that we know of this, of Onan, the son of Yehuda, where he was selfish, and he didn't want to have a child that was going to be in the name of his brother. Right? Maybe the rivalry there was so great that it overrode the closeness that the Sefer HaChinuch is describing. So while it's a mitzvah and it's built in place because it recognizes the closeness of the sibling relationship, at the same time, it also recognizes that that might not be the reality with every pair of brothers. That one brother may not want to do that chesed for the other brother, and there's an out. Now, the whole process of chalitza is a little bit, you know, you remove the shoe and then she spits in it. It's definitely degrading. You know, it's saying this is not the ideal. This really isn't the choice you should be taking. But nevertheless, it is a legitimate option. All right? So in my region, maybe there are more mitzvot of obligations between siblings. I didn't find any others. This was it. So when we're talking about, you know, the closeness of the relationship, halacha doesn't seem to reflect too much of that. Halacha seems to almost be, you know, acknowledging that there's going to be rivalry and that the nature of the relationship doesn't have to extend that far. That, you know, if they're not close with each other, you know, they have the same obligations as they would towards anyone else, but not anything special and unique just because they're siblings with each other. That's from a halachic perspective. What about from a hashgafic perspective? Philosophically, how does Yahadut view the sibling relationship? So there I think we see some things that are a little bit more juicy. Take a look at source number 9. We have a pasuk in Mishlei. It says, V'chol eitz ohev hareya, v'ach l'tzara yivaled. A friend's love is for all times, and a brother is born for tzara, right? For affliction, for trouble. What does that mean? What does that mean? I mean, it sounds like a friend is wonderful. A friend is always there for you. No matter what you're going through in life, they choose to be there with you. Whereas a brother, it's only tzaras. Right? That's what it sounds like the picture is painting. Like, I'd much rather have a friend than a brother. That's what it seems to be saying. But look at the Metudat David. He explains it a little bit nicer than that. Correct. There are numerous interpretations. But let's see what the Metudat David says. It's still in source number 9. It says, "Ratzalomar avat hareim hi b'chol eit bein b'yom tova bein b'eit sara." Right? That with a friend who chooses to be with you because they like everything, almost everything there is to like about you. They like enough that they're willing to overlook the flaws. They will be there at, you know, the good days and the bad days. Aval avat ha'ach einat mida. But the love of a brother is not consistent. It isn't always there. There's going to be that jealousy and rivalry. That's just the nature of the relationship. The rock devotes Sarah Alechav as Yashuv Lihishadelbo. But one thing you can count on your brother, if there's trouble, he's going to be there for you. Right? He may not be there in the good times. He may not, you know, he may begrudge you some of the things that you're getting good in life. But if there's trouble, says Metsudat David, your brother's going to be there. Ki atzmo uvasarohu, because he is your bone and he is your flesh. Ve'im kein harehu ke'elu ha'ach nolad l'toelet v'tzara. And therefore, it seems like the brother is just born for trouble. So I know we had a, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the author, I think his name is Kevin Henkes. He wrote very cute children's books, and he had one book called Julius, Baby of the World. Anyone familiar with that story? So it was about this little girl whose parents have a baby, and she is just furious with the presence of this child. She doesn't want to share anything with it. She whispers mean things into his crib at night. She wakes him up from his nap. I mean, just as rude could be from a child to a baby sibling. And then there's a big party in the house to welcome this baby, and all the relatives come over, and one of the cousins starts sneering at that baby. Oh, that baby smells, and he's ugly, and he's drooling, and he needs his diaper changed. And all of a sudden, this sister, who was so antagonistic towards her brother, became the most defensive protector, right? She was yelling at her cousin and insisting that she say nice things to the baby, all the nice things the parents wanted her to say. Now she says it, right? I think that's the idea here that the Pesach and Mishlei is teaching us, that the bond does exist, and it doesn't get ignored, although inherently it might not always be present. Right? That you can always count on your brother when times are difficult, but it's not going to be a constant, always positive relationship. All right, that's pasuk number one. Pasuk number two, source number 10, in Tehillim, a pasuk we're very, very familiar with. Shir Hamalot LeDavid, Hine Matov U'Manayim, Shevet Achim Gam Yachad. Right? How beautiful and how wonderful is it when brothers dwell together, right, in unity. So it is beautiful and wonderful, right, when there's unity, when there's, the sibling rivalry doesn't exist. But what's the implication of this pasuk when you have to say hine matovu manayim, that is the ideal, that's what we strive for, meaning the given is that's not the case, right? We cannot assume that is going to be the natural state, that brothers will dwell together in peace and harmony and achdut. Right? The assumption is just the opposite. And it's wonderful when we can overcome that. And look at the Midrash, source number 11. Who specifically does the Midrash say this pasuk is referring to? K'moshe v'Aaron, right? Moshe and Aaron. Shne'emar hine matov v'manayim. When did they dwell together in peace? When was there unity amongst them? Shehayu ohavim ze lazeh. And they, because they really loved each other. U'mechavavim ze lazeh. They cherished each other. Moshe et Hamalchut, because when Moshe became the king of the Jewish people, Vaharon Kuhuna Gadola, when Aaron was appointed to be the Kohen Gadol, Lo Kinu Zebazeh, they weren't jealous of each other. Ela Hayu Smechin, but they rejoiced with each other. Hein Bigdulazeh, Vizel Bigdulazeh. Right? Each one rejoiced for the other. Rather than exhibiting jealousy, why did you get this and I should have gotten that, there was a love and a support for each other. The jealousy did not exist. But again, they're held up as the model. There, you know, how many cases of brothers in Tanakh can we hold up as a model like this? Right? The only other ones I can think of is Ephraim and Menashe. Right? We bless our sons on Friday night to be like Ephraim and Menashe. One of the reasons given is because they were the first siblings that actually got along with each other. That when Yaakov blessed them, right, we know he crossed his hands famously because he recognized that the younger one was going to supersede the older one in greatness, and the older one didn't harbor any jealousy or ill feelings, so we bless our sons that they shouldn't have that jealousy and that rivalry between them. But besides Moshe and Aaron and Ephraim and Menashe, I mean, you think in your head, can you come up with any other pair of brothers that got along so well? Yosef and Binyamin. Okay, good. That's true. Yeah. I'm sorry? Yisrael and Zebulun. Okay. I'm getting a lot of examples. Yes. It's a growth process, correct. But if you start from the beginning, Cain and Hevel, who were the first siblings, that was the first case of murder, right? They, I mean, it wasn't just fighting over a piece of pie. they literally killed each other. You go to Shem, Ham, and Yafet. it doesn't say they necessarily fought with each other, but one of the interpretations of what Ham did to his father when he went in there, right, and then the brothers had to go in and cover him up, one of the approaches is that he castrated his father, and he did it because he didn't want any more siblings. Right? There were enough siblings. We don't need to fight over inheritance anymore. We got enough, you know, enough people who have to cut up the pie. And then you've got Yaakov and Esav. You've got Yitzchak and Yishmael. You've got Yosef and versus his brothers. It just seems like, you know, case after case. And these were not wicked people. These were righteous people. You know, even the ones who were righteous still exhibited this rivalry and this enmity towards each other. And again, not over who washes first and who gets to sit in the front seat, but over real serious issues of inheritance, of inheriting a legacy, of who's gonna take over the land. I mean, these were bitter, bitter, bitter rivalries that took place. When we say Hinei Matov Manayim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad, that's what we're striving for. That's what we're growing towards. But it's not a given. It's not something that we can assume is always going to be the case. One other pasuk, though, that I want to bring down that I think is, especially fitting to be discussed in the shir of women. Okay, look at source number 12. Because so far we've used the term achim, right, or ach. And there is no generic, or like in English we say siblings, and that's generic for brothers or sisters. In Hebrew there's no generic word. So we could say achim could be talking in generic terms, right? When we use it in the first two psukim that we read together, maybe it's referring to brothers and sisters. But we do have a pasuk that indicates sisters, just sisters alone. Take a look at source number 12. Also from Mishlei, it says, Emor lechachma achoti at. Say to wisdom, you are my sister. I think it was on a modala bina tikran, to someone who you know, that's what you call understanding. But I'm more interested in the first part of the pasuk. Emor lechachma achoti at. Say to wisdom, you are my sister. Specifically, my sister, not my brother. Right? So why sister? Why does it, you know, pull out that relationship? So if you look at the Mefarshim, which I didn't put down because there were so many that commented on it, but let me just read to you some of the terminologies that they used to describe this. Rashi, he says you should view wisdom as close to you as your sister is close to you. Right? There's something about the dynamic of that relationship, but there's a closeness there, karovna, that's how intimate you should be with wisdom. The Ralbag says you should love wisdom like you love your sister. The word le'ehov. The Mitzudat David says you should be familiar with wisdom like you are familiar with your sister. Uses the word ragil. The Gra and the Meiri say that you should be inseparable with wisdom, like your relationship with your sister is inseparable. And they use the word davuka, right? Like it's a glue. You're stuck together in a positive way. Like you want to be that close with your sister. The Shaarei Chaim says you should be willing to sacrifice for wisdom like you would be willing to sacrifice for your sister. And Rav Hirsch comments that wisdom, like a sister, is our father's daughter. Right? Wisdom is the daughter of God, and something Hashem gave us to be like a watchful and protective sister. And so when you go through these commentaries, commenting on the word sister, as opposed to the word brother, right? What do you see here? There's no ambivalence. There's no questioning the nature of the relationship. We're not talking about this is the ideal and maybe we can get there if we work hard and if we progress and we evolve. It is taking this as a given that when you have a sister, there's a closeness. When you have a sister, there's a bond. There's love. You're willing to sacrifice. You're willing to go out of your way to protect. And she will go out of her way to protect you. Right? And wisdom, which is, you know, one of the high chachmas, the highest priority we have. Here, Mishlei Shlomo HaMelech is comparing it to the relationship that we have with a sister. You know, anecdotally, we saw that these brotherly relationships, even amongst the most righteous of families, were fraught with tension. But what about anecdotally sister relationships? Let's look at a few sources of sister relationships anecdotally in Tanakh, right? What do we see when it comes to the relationships with sisters? So let's start with, we already mentioned Aaron and Moshe as a exception to the rule for the brothers, but there was another sibling in the mix, right? There was Miriam. She was the sister. So what do we know about Miriam? Take a look at source number 13. So we know even before Moshe was born, Miriam was already looking out for him, right? How did that come to be? Source number 13, the Gemara in Sota. Amra lo bito. Amram's daughter said to him, right? Well, Amram was the Gadol Hador, and we know the background to this Gemara is he separated from his wife because he thought, what's the point of bringing more children into this world? We're slaves, there's a decree they're getting thrown into the Nile, there's a 50% chance we're going to have a boy, he's going to get killed. Even if it's a girl and she survives, what kind of a life can we give her? It's better to just not bring children into the world. And that's a tough argument to contend with. He's got a point. Who does want to bring children into a world that's so miserable? And he's separated from his wife, and being the Gadol Hador, all the other men of the generation followed his example and separated from their wives as well. Miriam confronts him. And she says, Abba, kashe gezeiracha yoter mishel paro. Right? Famous line, famous chutzpah on Miriam's part. Your decree is harsher than Pharaoh's. I mean, imagine a child saying to her father, you're worse than Pharaoh. You're worse than Hitler. You're worse than Ahmadinejad. I mean, think of all the names we could plug in there, but that's what she was telling him. Shepara lo gazar ela hazacharim, v'ata gazarta al hazacharim v'al hanekevot. Right? Paro's only killing the boys. By you not having children and setting the example for everyone else to not have children, there's not going to be any girls either. Paro at least was willing to let the girls live. You're preventing them from having life. Paro lo gazar ela ba'olam hazeh, ba'atab olam hazeh ul'olam haba. Argument number two, by these children not being born, even if they would be born and they would die, then at least they could have life in the next world. But by not being born, you're not giving them life in either world, not in this world and not in the next world. Paro harasha steik mitkayemet gezerato, safek eno mitkayemet. Paro's an evil man. Maybe people are going to listen to him. Maybe they're not, right? But you, atat, tzadik bevadai shi gezeratcha mitkayemet. But you are a righteous man. Everyone's going to follow your example. Right? Some people might resist Paro. No one's going to resist you. And so she points out, point after point after point, how he has let them down, and how he is worse than Pharaoh in terms of propagating the Jewish people. It goes on, Amad v'hachazir et ishto. So he listened to her. Her words sank in. He returns to his wife, Amdu kulam v'hachaziro et nishotehan. And everyone else got up and remarried as well. Now, what was motivating Miriam to do this, other than the continuity of the Jewish people? She had a personal negiah on this. She had a prophecy that her parents were destined to bear the savior of the Jewish people. Right? Atidin, in the future, my mother is going to be the mother of the savior of the Jewish people. And if they weren't married, that wasn't going to happen. So she was already looking out for her brother, paving the way for his existence by getting her parents back together. But what happens? They get back together. Moshe is born. The house is filled with light. Everybody's thrilled, right? This is the best thing. She was 100% right. And then, now it's getting close to the time. We know she gave birth 3 months early. But after a certain amount of time that they were able to keep Moshe at home, the Egyptians were going to come around looking for him, ready to toss him into the Nile River with all the other babies that they were killing. So what happens at that point? Look at source number 14. Batitatse v'chotome rachok. It says it describes Miriam standing from afar when Amram and Yocheved built that little basket that they put baby Moshe in to try to save him in the Nile. It says that Miriam was standing from afar. Well, that bothers the Midrash. Why weren't the parents standing and watching? Why was it Miriam who was there? So what does it say? Lama amda Miriam erechok. Why was she the one standing there? Amram b'shem Rav. Lefi shayita Miriam mitnabe ba'omeret. Atida imi shetelei ben sheoshiat Yisrael. Because Miriam was the one who had this prophecy that her mother was going to give birth to the savior of the Jewish people. Kevan shenolad Moshe nitmalei kol habayit ora, and when he was born, the whole house was filled with light. Amad aviha v'nashka al rosha, her father kissed her on her head. He was so delighted with how everything was happening. Amar la biti nitkaiman nevuateich, my daughter, your prophecy has been fulfilled. The kevan shehid luhu layor. But when they had to put him into the river, amda ima v'tafchala al rosha. Right, what a contrast that is. Her mother whacked her on the head, right? As opposed to the kiss of joy that her father gave her, now her mother whacks her. What happened to your prophecy now? Right here, I mean, imagine the terror of parents having to put their baby in this. So yes, he was in a basket, but what were his chances of survival? Slim to none. And they couldn't watch. They walked away and they were furious at Miriam. All their grief and all their fear for this child, they projected onto her. And they told her what happened. Amra lo biti veheichan nevuateich. What happened to your prophecy? V'hainu dichtiva titatzeach oto merachok. And that's why it says she was the one who was there. Ladat ma yehe besof nevuata. Because she, her parents had given up on her. They lost faith in her prophecy, but she had not. She knew that this was not the end of Moshe. She stood over. She was that protective sister, that loving sister who watched over him. And didn't take very long to see what was going to happen, right? Where does he end up floating? Right by Bat Paro. And then with her same sense of chutzpah, she approaches the princess and offers to go get a wet nurse and brings her own mother, right, to come nurse this child. It was because of Miriam, this watchful, protective sister, that Moshe was able to be born and raised and nurtured into the man who was ultimately going to save the Jewish people. It was the sister who brought that about. Okay, that's example number one. Oh, sorry, one more case with Miriam, and then we'll move on. Source number 15. So we see another beautiful example of the bond between these siblings here. When she was older, this was later in her life, when she is stricken with saras, right? She and Aaron engaged in some lashon hara about their brother, and she was punished with saras. And Aaron goes to intercede to Moshe that he should pray for her, that she should recover. Because they didn't know in the outset that it was only going to last 7 days and then she would be fine. And the Gemara in Sota, where this whole conversation about Miriam takes place, describes numerous psukim from Divrei Hayamim that attribute different names to Miriam that indicate that she was sick as a child. As a child, she wasn't so healthy. And her two brothers had to watch this beloved sister suffer all kinds of health challenges growing up. And it wasn't until she married Kalev, says the Gemara, that he was able to kind of nurture her back to health. He, you know, gave her the right exercise and the right nutrition. And he was the one that was able to nurture her back to health. But imagine the trauma of brothers who grew up with a sister that was sick, now going into, you know, having a relapse, right? Here she was sick again. It's hard enough to see her being sick once, but it's dredging up all those old memories of all the times that she was sick. And it's painful for them. It's painful for Aaron. And he makes an unusual statement to Moshe. The first line of the Sephorno is quoting the Pasuk in Source 15. It says, Ana tehi kamet asher b'tseito me'recham imo v'yochal chatzi b'saro. Don't be like the dead fetus that comes out from the womb of its mother with half of its flesh consumed. I mean, what kind of a statement is that for Aaron to make to Moshe in terms of pleading with him? That sounds more like a poster, you know, a slogan you're going to see at a pro-life rally, talking about dead fetuses and consumed flesh. What is he referring to here? So the Sforno comments. Hineha over shehu mate ba'ofen zeh, right? A fetus that dies in this manner. Shebetseito merecha mimo ne'achal v'nikakel chatzi b'saro, where when it emerges from the womb of its mother, half of its flesh is consumed and destroyed. Afal pi shenireh shehu mosif shleimut b'leida, even though it seems like when it comes out and it's born, it will be more lifelike, it will be more complete because it's in the land of the living. Al mashe hayalo betanimo, more so than when it was inside the womb of his mother. But say tomi sham el makom hachayim hashleimim, when it comes out into a place of complete life. Hu amna mosif garon, it becomes really even more deficient. Right? You might think it would be an improvement for this dead fetus to be born, but no, it's really to its detriment. Because in the course of its birth, whatever deficiencies this poor fetus had, its flesh is half consumed. And here's what the Sforno says Aaron is referring to. Kein ata hayotze min hamidbar. It's going to be the same when we leave the Midbar. V'nichnas la'eretz hanibcheret, and we enter into the land of Israel. He's making an analogy. Being in the Midbar is like being in the womb. Entering the land of Israel is being born. V'zeh heitiv machol m'shiptecha. This is definitely an improvement. To leave the Midbar and go into the land of Israel, absolutely an improvement. Al na tehi ka'oto hamet. But wait, Moshe. Don't be like that fetus. Sheteinia chatzi b'sarcha b'midbar. That leaves half of its flesh behind in the desert, right? If you don't pray for Miriam, if you don't beseech God for her recovery, we, siblings, our sister is part of us. We are one flesh. We came from the same womb. We grew in the same womb of our mother. And if we go on and she stays behind, It's like leaving part of ourselves behind. It's like a fetus that has half of its flesh consumed. Right? I mean, you see the bond? You see the closeness that exists here? Not just when they were children, but throughout their lives, this was the connection that Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam had with each other. Okay. Source number 16. Another example of siblings. This one is maybe not quite so well known. We read about this story on Tisha B'Av. It's the son and daughter of Rabbi Ishmael. It's in one of the keynote, but the Gemara has a version of the story as well. It says, Ma'aseh bivno uvevito shel Rabbi Ishmael ben Elisha. It's the story of the son and the daughter of Rabbi Ishmael ben Elisha. Shenishbu lishnei adonim. They were captured after the Chorban, and they were sold to two different masters as slaves. And it just so happened these two masters, these two slave owners, met up with each other. Ze Omer. So one of them was bragging, and he said, Yeshli eved she'ein kiyofyo b'chol ha'olam. I have a slave who's the most gorgeous person you've ever seen in your life. No one's as handsome as he is. Ze Omer yeshli shivcha she'ein b'chol ha'olam kolo kiyofya. And I have a maidservant, I have a slave woman, who's also the most beautiful person I've ever laid eyes on. Amru, so they came up with a plan. Bo unisiyem zelazeh, let's breed the two of them together. They didn't see them as human beings, they saw them as property. Let's breed the two of them together. Unachalek bivladot, and we'll divide up the children. Imagine, you know, the currency that we could get for these beautiful children that they'll produce. Hichnisum l'cheder. So they put the two of them together in a room. Ze yashav bekeren zavid ze. One sat in one corner. Ve'zo yeshva bekeren zavid ze. And the other one sat in the other corner. Ze omer. The son said, Ani kohen ben kohanim gedolim. Esa shivcha. Right? I'm a kohen, the son of kohen gedolim. I'm such an illustrious history, such an illustrious liyichus. And is this my destiny? Is this my fate to be married to a slave girl? And she said, Ani kohenet bat kohanim gedolim. And Asela Eved, right? She had the same sentiment. They didn't realize that it was the two siblings sitting together in the same room. It was dark. They couldn't see anything. They each sat all night and bemoaned their fate. Kol halayla. Kevan she'ala amud hashachar. And then when the sun came up and there was light in the room and they could see, hikiru ze'edzeh. They recognized each other. V'naflu zeh al zeh, and they fell upon each other. V'ga'u bivcheha ad sheyatza nishmatan. And they cried and they cried out their grief until they expired, until their souls left them. V'alehem ponin Yirmiyahu, and on them, Yirmiyahu makes the famous statement, al eila ani bochiya eini eini yardamayim. What do we see here? We go back to that pasuk in Mishlei. The love, the connection, the connectedness that a brother and a sister, specifically a sister, have towards each other. They were so connected that they died in each other's arms of the grief that they felt for each other. There was it's a tragedy, but it illustrates, again, I think the Jewish perspective on the relationship here, that when it comes to a sister, there's a given, there's an inherent closeness and bond that even in tragedy is not broken. Take a look at source number 17. We'll run through examples. We started late, we can end late. Is that okay? I don't want to keep everybody from... Okay, I got a few more sources to go through. Source number 17 and 18, right? Rachel and Leah. Also very famous, well-known sisters. And, you know, what happened to them? These poor girls. These poor girls. Yaakov had come. He saw Rachel. He fell in love with her. Love at first sight. You know, struck a deal with her father Lavan to work for 7 years. The pasuk tells us it was as if it was like a day in his eyes because he was so much in love with her. Whatever it took to be together with her, that's what it was going to take. And then comes the wedding night. What does Lavan do? I don't want to marry off the younger one before the older one. I don't want to lose a good employee that I've had now all of these years. So he's going to put Leah in place of Rachel. Now, they were smart, Rachel and Yaakov. And they knew that Lavan was not straight. And they knew that he would try to pull some kind of shtick. And they planned for this. They anticipated it. They came up with simanim, right? Some kind of signs that only Rachel knew. And when Yaakov asked her to identify herself, If she gave the signs, he would know it was Rachel. If she didn't give the signs, he would know that Laban was tricking, right? What happens? Source number 17. Kafsa Rachel imenu lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rachel jumps up in front of God when she's, there's a midrash where she's pleading the case of the Jewish people. Va'amara, and she says, Ribono shel olam, galoy lefanecha sheYaakov avdecha ahavani ahava yeterah. Yaakov, your servant, loved me with a tremendous love. Va'avad bishvili la'aba sheva shanim. He worked for 7 years. Keshlimu otan sheva shanim. And when those 7 years were up, hi'giyazman nesuei la'ba'ali, and it was time to marry my husband. Ya'atz avi la'achlifeni la'ba'ali bishvil achoti. He was going to switch me for my sister. V'hukshat alay adavar ad ma'od. This was a very difficult thing. Ki nod'a li ha'etza. Hodati leba'ali, umasarti lo siman, shiakir beni uvenachoti. Right? But we came up with these signs. We knew how to avoid this pitfall. Kadei shelo yuchal avi lachlifeni, so that my father couldn't trick us. He couldn't switch me. La'achar came. But after a while, you know, here we were so confident and so, you know, comfortable with what we had set up. Nichamti ba'atzmi. I started to regret this. And I started to calm my desire for my husband. And I had compassion on my sister. That she shouldn't be humiliated. Because what would happen to her? Yaakov asked for the simanim. She doesn't know them. And then he'd point to her and make a whole stink. And here, poor Leah, right? She would be the one to suffer in all of this. And that night when he switched my sister for me, I gave her all the signs. I gave all the simanim to my sister. So that he would know, or he would think, that she was Rachel. And not just that, but I actually hid under the wedding bed that he was in with my sister that night. Right? So that when he would talk to her, she wouldn't answer. My voice from under the bed is what he would hear, so she wouldn't be, you know, our secret would not be revealed. I mean, imagine that sacrifice that the sister was willing to make for her. Not recognize my voice. Vegamalti chesed ima, and I did a chesed for her. Velo kinati ba, and I wasn't jealous of her. Velo hotseita lecherpa, and I did not send her out to her shame. Right, this was the sacrifice that one sister made for another, and if that's not the ultimate sacrifice, I don't know what is. And we know it engendered lots of sibling rivalry as a result of Yaakov having more than one wife. So all the brothers, you know, amongst each other, that's where the sibling rivalry came from. But amongst the two mothers, and we know the Hebrew word for a co-wife is a tzara. Because there's no such, you can't have that. You can't have, you know, try to have two women share one sweater or one pair of shoes, right, or one kitchen. Doesn't work very well. But have them share a husband, forget about it, right? But here, she was willing to make that sacrifice because it was her sister. And the favor is returned. The favor is returned. It wasn't without gratitude. Look at 18, right? Before Dina was born, when Leah got pregnant, Dina was child number 7 for Leah. What did she say? The Gemara is explaining her name. Why did she name her Dina? Shedana Leah Dina Ba'atma. That Leah judged herself at that time. Va'amra, and she said, Shnei Masar Shvatim Atidin Latzeit Miyakov. Right? We all know the Nebuah that there will be 12 tribes born from Yaakov. Shisha Yatsu Mimenu. Right? I've already given birth to 6. I already have half. Do the math. Varba'a Min Hashvachot. And the two, you know, Bilhah and Zilpah each have 2 of them also. Harei Asara, that makes 10. Im ze zachar, if this child that I am pregnant with now is a boy, lo tehe achoti Rachel achat hashvachot. My sister, right, there'll only be one left. And my sister won't even be on the same footing, on the same equal level, in terms of contributing to the shvatim as the maidservants. So what does she do? She asks God to ensure that her child is a daughter, so that the son can be born from Rachel. Miyad nefechet labat. Right? And immediately God changed the gender of the fetus into a daughter. That's where Dina got her name. So again, Rachel and Leah, sisters. Emor l'chachma achotiat, right? The sister relationship is one of love, is one of sacrifice, is one of connection, is one of being bonded to each other. And we see again from the two of them what they were willing to do for each other. Talking about Dina, right? We'll give another one here. So we know the tragedy of Dina. She had gone out to see what was going on in the town, and she was abducted and kidnapped by Shechem. She was raped, and after that experience, Shechem fell in love with her and wanted to marry her. So he sends a message of his father back to Yaakov. The mindset we can't even imagine, that he would have the chutzpah to come to the father of the daughter that he kidnapped and raped and say, I want to marry her, I love her, right? What father in his right mind would ever allow his daughter to be with such a man? But he comes and he strikes a deal, and they have to think cleverly how we can do this. You know, he can't just say no and yell at him, because Dina is still in their charge. And so they have to be very gentle, you know, to figure out a way to get Dina back. So they come up with a very clever plan. They said to him, look, we would love to marry our daughter off to you. The problem is, we're all circumcised, and you guys are not. So if you and all of your people are willing to undergo circumcision, then it'll be great, right? And they thought that was very clever, because even if Shechem was desperate enough to undergo such a procedure, they figured in a million years he'll never be able to convince all of the people in his town to undergo such a procedure. What's in it for them? Right? But Shechem was such a good salesman that he convinced them that there was something in it for them. We'll join in their businesses. They're wealthy. We'll marry their daughters. Right? We'll become this great community. Yaakov had a tremendous reputation there. And he was able to convince them all to undergo circumcision. So we'll never know how Yaakov would have handled that, because two of Dina's brothers, Shimon and Levi, take matters into their own hands. They go into the town of Shechem, they assassinate everybody, they bring Dina back. And when they come back successful, I mean, against all odds, two against an entire town, when they come back successful, Yaakov is angry with them. Yaakov says, you made me look like a liar, right? You killed my reputation. And their defense was, Hachzona yas et achotenu, right? Do we let them turn our sister into a prostitute? Do we let them treat our family that way? Right? Everyone's got to be afraid of us. The point that's made here in source number 19, it says, Shimon v'Levi achei Dina. Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dina, they're the ones that went into the town, and they're the ones that defended her honor and got her back. Halo achot kol hashvatim hayta? But wasn't she the sister of all of them? Right? Why does it specify Shimon and Levi? She had numerous brothers, not just two. Ma tamar lomar achei Dina. You know why he calls them the brother of Dina? El lefi shenatno nafsham aleha, nikrei achotam al shmam. Why was she referred to as their sister? Because of the sacrifice that they were willing to make for her. They put their lives at risk. Right? That protectiveness that we were talking about, that love, that connection, that defending of her honor, because they were the ones willing to go the extra mile for her, they're the ones called her brothers. Everyone else had the same genetic relationship, but they had the closeness. They had the bond. Okay. Let's sum up for just a minute, and then we'll conclude with our final source. So again, we went through some of the halakhic sources. And we did not find anything, you know, special in halacha that recognizes the closeness of the sibling relationship. And perhaps, I'm just suggesting, that's because the rivalry of the sibling relationship is so real that it would be unfair to create an obligation when there is jealousy and rivalry. Philosophically and anecdotally, however, there seems to be a differentiation in the relationship of brothers versus sisters, right? The brother relationship, from what we've seen in the psukim and in the examples, seems to reflect the rival aspect of the sibling relationship, the one pole. And the sister relationship, based on the psukim and the mefarshim and the anecdotal evidence, seems to reflect the close bond aspect of the sibling relationship. If we have to, you know, to look at the two poles, the brothers reflect one, the sisters reflect the other side. And maybe it's not so surprising. Maybe the nature of women is to be more nurturing and not as aggressive and not as, and maybe this isn't a popular thing to say, but there's a certain quality that women have that maybe engenders that closeness between the siblings. You know, I leave that open to your own interpretation. But we certainly see it with Miriam, Moshe, and Aaron, with the son and daughter, Rabbi Yishmael, with Rachel and Leah, with Levi, Shimon, and Dinah. They're all examples of the love and familiarity and connectedness, protectiveness, and sacrifice that was derived from that pasuk of Amor L'Chachma Achotiat. The last example I want to share with you, I thought this one was just fascinating. It's a story of Hannah, the daughter of Matityahu. Right? She was from the time of the Hanukkah story, the sibling of the Maccabees. You know, where the pasuk says Amor L'Chachma Achotiat, say to wisdom, you are my sister. In this example, what I think it illustrates is that the sister is the wisdom. The sister is the wisdom. It's not necessarily describing the love and the protectiveness of the relationship. It is, but because the sister is the one who proposes it. She's the one who opens her brother's eyes to what needs to be done for her protection and ultimately for the protection of all of the Jewish people. Let's read it inside and we'll conclude with this. Kevan Sheru Yivanim, She'en Yisrael Margishin Gezerotehem, Amdu V'Gazru Olehem Gezera Marav Achura. Right? The Greeks were getting frustrated with the Jews, that they weren't obeying everything that they had tried to get them to obey. So they came up with a particularly bitter and difficult decree. Shelo Tikanes Kala, Balaila Harishon Mechupata, that when a Jewish girl would get married, before she could spend the night with her husband, she had to spend the night with the Jewish general who was in wherever she was. All right? I mean, really a terrible, terrible thing. No. Sorry, a Greek general. Did I say Jewish? I apologize. A Greek general. Wherever, whoever was the general in the township where the wedding took place, that's who she had to be with before she could be with her husband. Kevan Sheshamu Yisrael Kach, and when the Jewish people heard this, Rafu Yadeyan B'Tashash Kocham U'Manu Mila Ars. Right? It was a terrible, tragic thing. Their strength was sapped. They threw up their hands in frustration. It was almost like they were preventing marriages from taking place. Hayu Benot Yisrael Bogrot U'Mizkenot K'Shehen B'Tulot. And it was especially disheartening and depressing to the Jewish girls because they were virgins. They were moral people. They lived a moral lifestyle. V'nitkayim aleihem b'tulotah nogot v'hi marla. Right? The pasuk in Eicha that describes the affliction of the betulot definitely applied to them, the bitterness that became their lot. V'hayu yivanim mit ololot b'betulot Yisrael. And so the Greeks would abuse the Jewish women. V'nahagu v'devar hazeh shalosh shanim u'shmoneh chadashim. And this was going on for how long? 3 years and 8 months this decree was taking place. And all the women who got married had to succumb to this. Ad shabo ma'aseh shabat Matityahu kohen gadol. Until this thing happened with the daughter of Matityahu the kohen gadol. Shenoseit leben chashmonai ve'elazar hayashmo. Until it was the night of her wedding. And she was marrying Elazar, the son of the chashmonai. Kevan shehigia yom simchata hoshibuha ba'aparyon. And the day of her wedding arrived, they brought her in on like a throne type of chair. U'kishehigia zaman ha'su'uda yitkapsu kol gedola Yisrael l'chavot Matityahu u'ben chashmonai shelo hayu ba'oto hadora gedolim mehem. Right? You can imagine this wedding. It was the marriage of two dynasties, right? You can those Hasidish weddings where thousands of people come because it's this Rebbe's daughter marrying this Rebbe's son, and everybody was there to honor the fathers of this couple. When they sat down to have their feast, Amdaj, Chana bat Matityahu, this was her name, Chana got up, Me'al Apiryon, from the bridal seat that she was sitting on, V'sapka kapeha zo al zo, V'kara porpiron shela, V'amda l'pnei kol Yisrael k'shehi megula. What did she do? She basically stripped her clothes off in front of everybody there at the wedding. Shocking. Absolutely shocking. V'lifnei aviha v'ima v'chosna. She did this in front of her father, in front of her mother, in front of her husband, and in front of all the gedolim who were there to be part of this wedding. Kevan shera'u acheha kach. When her brothers saw this, nidbaishu, right? They were humiliated. V'natnu p'nehem b'karka v'karu b'gdehem. They averted their faces to the ground, and they tore their clothes. What got into our sister? Why is she so deranged? Why is she embarrassing us like this? V'amdu alei ala harga. And they wanted to kill her for the shame that she brought onto the family. Amra lahem, but she said to them, Shima'uni achai v'dodai. Listen to me, my brothers, my beloved ones. Ma im bishvil she'amadati lifnei tzadikim aruma. Right, I'm standing in front of righteous people in the state of nakedness. B'li shum aveira, I haven't done anything wrong. Hare atem mitkan im bi. You are jealous on my account, right? You're a zealot because of what I've done. Ve'ein atem mitkanin l'masrani biyad aral l'hitolel bi. Where is your zealotry when it comes to delivering me to the Greek soldier who I have to be with tonight? Halo yesh lachem l'lmod mishimon v'levi achei Dina, right? The Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dina. Why can't you be like them? Shelo hayu ela shnayim. There were only two of them. V'kanu la'achotam, but they were zealous on behalf of their sister. V'hargu karach k'shchem, they killed many people in Shchem. U'masru nafsham al yichud shel makom ve'ezram Hashem. And they were willing to sacrifice their lives for the oneness of God, and God helped them. V'lo hichlimam. V'atem chamisha achim. You're five. They were only two. You're five. Yehuda, Yochanan, Yonatan, Shimon, Belazar. U'firche kuhuna yoter mitayim b'chor. And from, you know, all the other Kohanim, there's at least 200 of you. Simu bitchonchem al hamakom. Put your faith in God. V'hu ya'azor etchem, and he will help you. Shene'emar ki ein ma'asor la'Hashem b'hoshia. Right? She's a quote that Hashem will not restrain his help. And then she opened her mouth and she cried. Right, if you don't have mercy on me, have mercy on your holy name. And help us take revenge, right? Help Nekama happen. Here she was making a stand. For 3 years and 8 months, no one stood up on behalf of these poor women. It was their sisters. It was their daughters. And who was standing up for them? Nobody. They succumbed. They figured, we have no choice. It's life or death. We have to submit them. And she's saying no. She, the sister, is getting up, and boy, is she giving mussar to her brothers in probably the most shocking way you can imagine. But she got their attention, and she had something very important to say. What happens? Nadlu eitza zemizeh. So now that she had their attention, and they heard her, and her words sunk into their hearts, they started to figure out a plan. Va'amru, ba'uvni kacha chotenu, v'nolichena etzel hamelech hagadol. Let's take our sister to the greatest leader, not just the regular officer. V'namar lo achotenu bat kohen gadol. Our sister is the daughter of the high priest. Ve'im b'chol Yisrael gadol me'avinu. And he's the greatest one of all. You know, no one's more important than him. We're not going to give her just to some regular general, right? If you want our sister, she has to go to the head, because she's the daughter of the head. Ela im hamelach shehu gadol kamotenu. V'nichnasnu alav v'nehergehu v'netzei. So what's going to happen when this is very impressive. The daughter of the Kohen Gadol is going to go to the head. They bring her in, and that's when they assassinate him. Right, that's how they get their entrance, because they're on the presumption that they're delivering their sister, and instead they kill him. V'nachil acharkach v'avadav v'sarav, and then they went after his servants and his officers. V'Hashem yazreinu v'yisagbeinu, and Hashem made them victorious. Natlu eitza v'asal lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu teshuah gedola. Right, she's the one, according to this midrash, she's the one who got the ball rolling for the entire salvation, not just of the women from this decree, but the entire salvation of the Hanukkah story. And it was, again, it was the sister. And I would just, real quick conclusion, all of us here are women. If we're not only children, then we're sisters. And I hope that after today's shiur, we have a little more of an appreciation for the nature of what that relationship is. Thank you very much.